Good evening and welcome. It's really good to see you. Thank you very much for coming and to Wantage Baptist Church this evening. We don't usually come on a Saturday evening, so thank you for bracing the weather and joining us this evening. And welcome. And special welcome to Manoj. Thank you very much for joining us. He is an ex-Muslim, a property tycoon, and he's come here tonight to talk to us about an amazing loss, but an even greater gain. He's come to introduce us to his Savior, the Lord Jesus. And so that's exciting, isn't it, to hear what God has done in his life. And he's very welcome. He's been a teacher and a BAFTA award-winning TV writer, as well as I mentioned, the property tycoon. He's also the author of a book called Filthy Rich. And it just so happens that there's a table at the back with his books there. They're available tonight. So what I would like you to do is welcome Manoj as he comes to share with us his story.
Wants to be a millionaire.
I don't.
Have flashy flunkies everywhere.
I don't.
Who wants the bother of a country estate? Well,
thank you, Peter. Let's pray, and then we'll get on with the evening. Father, we thank you and praise you for being here with us. We thank you and praise you that you're such a wonderful Savior. And thank you and praise you, Father, for the work that you've done in Manoj's life. Thank you for the work that you're going to do in our lives. And we thank you and praise you that we're here tonight, not by any accident, but by divine appointment. And we just pray that you'll help us as we seek to hear your voice through Manoj this evening. And so we give you thanks that we commit ourselves to you now, Father, in the name of the Lord Jesus. Amen. You are very welcome to Wantage. Is this the first time you've been to Wantage?
It is, actually, yeah. I've never been to Wantage before. I can see there's lots of development happening, isn't there?
Yeah.
So I understand your town is expanding. I was told, is it?
That's right.
It's doubling in size.
Yeah, easy.
But yeah, no, it's first time here.
So you're very welcome, and hopefully that's not the last time you visit us, so that would be good. So I'm going to ask Manoj one or two questions. Okay, and there may be an opportunity at the end, if you've got a question that you don't think we've covered, or he's covered, then an opportunity for you to ask that as well at the end. And then afterwards, I'm going to read a verse from the Bible, I'm going to close in prayer, and hopefully you can go and eat the remainder of the refreshments, okay? So that would be good. So thank you. And did you grow up thinking, I want to be a property tycoon, or even to quote Jeremy Clarkson, I want to be a millionaire?
I definitely signed up to making money from a very early age. And these sort of thoughts of being, you know, being wealthy, of making money, really, my God, started to emerge from a young age when we moved out to East Africa to Nairobi and Kenya. And the reason we moved out there was, well, we were living in Watford, and my father's a civil engineer. And this is in the 70s. Due to the economic downturn, my father was made redundant as an engineer. And he did actually get offered another job. But then his brother in East Africa said, you know, why don't you come and join with me in the family business? And this seemed like too good an opportunity to miss, you know, sort of brothers working together as a formidable force. It was actually my grandfather's, you know, desire that his sons would really work together. He has three sons, and my father was here in the UK. So it was his desire that, look, wouldn't it be amazing if they could really, really pull it together? And so we uprooted and went to Kenya and settled down there. And, you know, on the surface, it would have looked like we were going to live the absolute life because we were given this incredible house. Now, we'd left this sort of small three-bed terraced house and moved into this ginormous house that my uncle owned. And it had like four bathrooms and it had like an acre land and all of the kind of nice stuff that you'd find in a big house. But there were lots and lots of issues that started to emerge very quickly, which was basically my uncle had dragged my father over to work for him, but he wasn't prepared to pay him a lot of money. And often the weekly money wasn't coming in weekly. And so there was always tension in the house, you know, between my mother and father, lots and lots of arguments, you know, when are you going to get paid? Because I've got to go and do the food shopping. So it was always around the food shopping. And so we kind of grew up in that environment where, although we're living in this lovely house, and we were actually sent to a private school by my uncle, but it was just the salary side wasn't coming in. And there was some kind of psychological, I don't know how to describe it, but my uncle did take, I think he took great pleasure from this. I don't know why. I don't know a lot of the history behind their sort of family life, but my father rarely talks about, you know, his family. But obviously, I think there's aspects of his childhood that he didn't enjoy. And sort of watching all of that, and my mother, she started to sort of bake cakes and run cookery classes to make ends meet. Although we never really went without food. You know, sort of witnessing all of that, I made a decision from an early age that I didn't want to be like my father. I was going to be my own boss, in charge of my own destiny. I'd have my own business. And the thing is, I was fed these incredible tales of my grandfather's rise to riches. He was an extraordinary man, very audacious. He'd built the first block of offices in Nairobi City Centre. But he was a flash person, and he made a lot of money, and he lost a lot of money. And the thing is, when you're fed these tales, and I didn't know him, you know, I think he passed away when I was probably about 5 or 6, but you kind of listen to these stories, and they do seep in. You know, you think that these things are not going to seep in, but they do, and you start thinking and imagining that, what if that could be me one day? And so that was my focus, really, from a very young age, to make money.
So that Christian, that home environment, was that Christian in any way?
No, and I think you mentioned I was Muslim background. That's probably my fault if I sent you anything wrong in my biography. I was actually raised in a Hindu household, and so that was my sort of upbringing. I mean, there's so many things that I could tell you about growing up in Watford, but really one of the vivid memories I had was actually going to the local Hare Krishna temple, and my father became absolutely fascinated with his own faith. He moved over from East Africa to the UK in the 60s, and many of you remember, you know, like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and a lot of bands were suddenly fascinated with Eastern religions. I don't know if you remember that era when they're suddenly like, you know, they're all going out to India. And so my father, if you imagine from a Hindu faith background, you suddenly see a lot of people that are not from Hindu backgrounds suddenly taking an interest in it. Well, it encourages you to, doesn't it? And that's what happened with my father. So he was fascinated. Oh, I better take an interest in my faith. And this happened just before we were born. And so growing up in a house where, you know, we were taken to the temple, you know, very, very regularly, and God was not an optional extra. We were encouraged to make, you know, God a part of our everyday lives.
Mm. Thank you very much. So when did you first hear the Christian message that you could understand about Jesus loves you?
I heard the Christian message in our school in Kenya, where we were enrolled in. It was a Christian-run school called Covina. And you might be thinking, you know, I mean, my father was a very devout Hindu. You know, goes to the temple all the time and was praying all the time. Even today, he chants for up to 4 or 5 hours a day. He wakes up really early. He would chant using the same words, you know, repeating time and time again over 4 hours. He's an extraordinary man. And you might be wondering, you know, why would they send, you know, my sister and I, I'm a twin, why send us to a Christian-run school? Well, for many Hindus, all roads lead to God. Not for all Hindus, but for many Hindus. So as far as they were concerned, you know, there's absolutely no problem. It's a good school. You know, we're really happy for you to go there. And in any event, they didn't expect me to start taking an interest in Christianity. But I did. I took a deep interest in it. I was hugely fascinated. If you think of it from a Hindu perspective, which is a works-based faith, like Islam is or Sikhism. You know, you earn your salvation. It's like you've got to earn a number of points. I mean, for Hindus, you're trying to get out of the reincarnation cycle. But ultimately, what you're seeking is salvation. And then you come across this story as a kid in a Christian-run school, which is basically the Creator God has died for the created. I mean, how do you get your head around that concept as a kid? You know, so what you're telling me is that God created me, and then you're saying that God then took on human flesh and then he died for me. You know, it's a story of the king dying for his servants. Now, you know, if you like into action kind of movies and stuff like that, the hero does not die. The hero never dies. And I was utterly blown away by this whole concept of grace. You know, this is a free gift of salvation. Very, very different sort of way of approaching salvation to what I was brought up with. So I was absolutely fascinated by it. And I used to go home and I used to debate with my father very, very regularly, which he wasn't expecting, you know, some heated debates. And in every Hindu household, you have one of these little temples, like this little shrine that you have in one of the bedrooms. And gradually that shrine got moved from one of the spare bedrooms into my room because my dad was so incensed with me. He said, my son's not going to be like become a Christian. And the thing is, because he wakes up at what time? 4 or 5 in the morning to do what? To chant. So he'd come into my room on a school day. This is on a school day. Every day, about 5 o'clock in the morning, and he'd come and pray. The lights on. But I was fascinated. But the thing is that, you know, my interest in Christianity started to wane of its own accord because I went on to secondary school. You know, other things start to preoccupy your mind, like girls, for example. Not the studies. It should have been the studies. But all the stuff, I suppose, that secondary school kids kind of get into. But there was one thing that I did hold on to, which was a school motto, which is Forces Fortuna Juvat. I don't know if there's any Latin kind of people in here, then I might have pronounced it wrong, but it means fortune favors the brave. And I really liked that school motto because I suppose it reminded me of some of the risk taking that my grandfather had done in business.
Thank you very much. You're obviously known for your success in the property market and all of that. Perhaps you could just tell us a bit about your success and how that sort of happened.
In the property market, yeah. So, well, the thing is, I'd signed up to make money through property. That was ultimately the goal. So I'd moved here to the UK. You know, I went and did my A levels. The problem was that I didn't get the results that I needed to go and venture into business. I got a good grade in my English. And so what happened was my life did a kind of a long detour for a number of years because I went through the clearing system, which is essentially if you don't get good enough grades, you get put into this system and then hopefully some university will take you. And the university I got a place in was Bangor University in North Wales, and I went there to study English. I don't know why I did better in English than I did in economics, for example, but I just did well in that subject. And for 3 years I was at university, if you go to university, you're going there to really enjoy yourself, aren't you? You've got to really enjoy the subject, but I don't remember one lecture thinking to myself that I'm enjoying this. So you're kind of stuck in this place for a few years. Anyway, I came out, scraping through with my second class, wondering what am I going to do with my life now, because I've got this English degree. And the thing is that as an Asian person, I felt guilty. You know, you feel guilty that, look, your parents have paid for you to kind of help you through university. Now, if I don't use this English degree, then actually, you know, it shows disrespect to my family. I went through a period where I was unemployed for a while because I couldn't do much with this English degree. And then I got a job selling furniture, which I absolutely loved. I know I'm digressing. I'll get onto property in a moment. But it's just the way that these interviews with me go. They do take a bit of a journey. But yeah, there I was in furniture for a while. I started off as a tea boy because that's what the job centre threw up. And I loved being there. I mean, I quickly moved from serving tea to actually selling furniture because I realised that if you serve really good coffee, Dowie Egbert coffee, I mean, just imagine this kind of situation. You know, you're in a furniture shop, so you imagine you're at home, you sit on a sofa, and if you drink coffee and you smell coffee, then you feel comfortable, don't you? And the thing is that none of the other salespeople served the coffee. So all I did was I moved from being the kind of tea boy for 2 weeks to selling furniture, but with the coffee. And I was closing all the deals. But that's what you do when you sell a house, isn't it? You put the coffee machine on, you make it smell nice, and you hope that people will buy your house. So, and I loved selling, you know, selling furniture. And the reason I'm sharing this is because my venture into property came through that experience of selling furniture. Because I realized that there are certain things that people want in life. Some people want a sofa, or some people want a property. You know, we're a nation of homeowners, aren't we? You know, the British love buying homes. And I realize everybody wants a nice sofa, because if you're watching something on the screen, you want to sit down comfortably. But I learned about the art of selling in furniture, which was never talk about the product. It's such a big product to buy, isn't it? When you think about it, £2,000-£3,000 sometimes for a piece of furniture. If it's a really good sofa, lifetime guarantee, you know, gosh, I could start selling some furniture now, but hardwood frame, you know, fully sprung. And I even sold my mother a sofa, actually. I used to get commission. And she's only just got rid of it. So after so many years, it was a good product. But you never talk about the product. That's what I learned, you know. Don't chase the people around the room, because they're here because they're interested in sofas. All you've got to do is make them feel comfortable, and that's where coffee came in. The thing is that I felt guilty, although I did very well in sales and earned very good commission. I felt guilty thinking that, you know, I need to do something with my degree. And at university, I will get onto property, but at university, I was going out with this girl I was one of those sad people at university that meets someone literally within the first few weeks. And so I'm meant to be at university having this wild kind of social life. And all these people are out having a laugh, you know, going to pubs and parties and all that kind of stuff. And I'm having my romantic meal, you know, with my girlfriend, you know, who I was with for 3 years. And anyway, she wanted to be a teacher. So we were together throughout university for 3 years. I did my furniture selling. And I kind of followed her into teaching. It's what she wanted to do. She was my first serious girlfriend. And I thought, you know, this is the one for me. You know, this was going to be it. I even bought the ring just as I got my job in my first school. And then she broke up with me. So I didn't even give her the opportunity to have this ring, basically. And I can't smile about it now, because it's been a long time. But back then I was cut up. But that whole process of sort of leaving university, you know, going into sales and then going into teaching just made me think, you know, this isn't really what I want to be doing. You know, I was really, really wanting to get involved in business, but I was stuck in this profession that I didn't really want to be in. It's a bit like university. You sometimes find yourself in this place thinking, you know, I've mapped out my life, but it's not really working out as it is. What I decided to do, because I didn't want to upset my parents by now leaving this profession, I had my eyes on business, but I thought I should try out a few things. And as I emerged from that kind of low point of splitting with my girlfriend, 5 years we were together, I thought to myself, let me take some risks, like my grandfather did. So let me move out of English teaching into something that doesn't involve marking. So let me move into drama teaching. I had a good friend, actually, by the way, that in terms of all his marking, this is what he did. He had this bin bag underneath his desk. And whenever the students used to do any work, if it was a long piece of work, he'd put it in the bin bag. And after a few weeks, the students forget to ask about the work. And guess what he does to the bin bag at the end of the year? You know, he ties it up and he takes it to the tip. Now, when somebody like that is your role model, you know you're in the wrong profession, don't you? Yeah. So I knew I was in the wrong profession, but I like the idea of drama teaching. We will get onto property. And drama teaching I like because there was no marking. And what happened in that experience of teaching drama is I encountered students that wouldn't get good grades, but they just loved, you know, being involved in a creative subject. And I used to see those really, really tough students, you know, disaffected students, because the school I was teaching in wasn't, You know, it was sort of like a sink school. And so it was a tough school to go into, but it was just extraordinary seeing how their lives were being transformed, you know, through drama. They were different people, and, you know, they weren't valued sometimes for the giftings that they had. And that touched me, and I kind of thought to myself, you know, I want to have a stab at this, actually doing this in a serious way. And I suppose many people might think, you know, it's crazy some of the ideas I had, but I kind of set up in my mind that, you know what, I'm going to try and do this professionally. I'm going to be a writer. I'm going to be a director. I went back to university while I was still working in school as a consultant, and I did this MA in drama and theatre studies, and I wrote a play with my new girlfriend, who's very witty, at university. Why did I write a play? Well, in this master's course, you didn't need to write any plays. You could just find a play at the end of the course and direct it. That was kind of like the plan. You know, you just go straight to an off-the-peg play, and that was what you needed to do. But I thought to myself, you know what? There's that whole thing about risk-taking. I'm going to get to business, but here I am. Those kids that I was teaching really impacted me. Why don't I just take a risk, write something of my own life story, maybe? And so I just wrote about a group of Asian kids caught between West and Eastern cultures. And my girlfriend back then, my wife now, really, really helped me. There was a problem. I went to Royal Holloway University, and all my cast were Asian. And the point was, during this MA, you have to find actors from the university. And the problem was, there were no Asian people at Royal Holloway University. And it only dawned upon me that, oh my goodness, so where am I going to find all these Asian people from to act in this play for my masters? So I advertised in the stage and got a group of actors together and just got them involved and said I'd take it up to the Edinburgh Festival for a laugh. And actually, it was probably in a church like this that we were there for a month in the Edinburgh Festival. The play was called BBA and Proud. It's not a great name. It means British-born Asian and proud. I thought it was a cool name, but anyway, nobody understood it and nobody really asked, so there you go. But there I was in this church building like this, playing to about five or six people every night. And then some of these really important people came in, you know, towards the end of the kind of the Edinburgh Festival. And they liked it. And they awarded it a Fringe First, which basically meant that loads of people were now going to come and see your play, which they did. So over the last few days, we were packed out. And the play toured, and it toured nationally in various theatres. And that got involved me in writing. And it was actually when my wife and I were writing this TV series that won a number of awards. But we were in America, because this was a big turning point towards property for me. It had won a BAFTA, it won an RTS award, and a glittering career was kind of awaiting me because this was now nominated for an international Emmy. So by this TV production company, I'm now sent across to New York, and I'm standing there in this ginormous room, and a thought struck me, which is, yeah, I've been on this kind of journey for a number of years, taking a few risks, not really doing what I want to do. And the thought struck me that actually it doesn't matter. If I don't win this international Emmy, it doesn't matter actually. You know, whether I won it or whether I didn't win it, I was going to feel no different. Because ultimately, really, it was those dreams and aspirations that I'd had about property, about business, that had really kind of caught me as a child that I really wanted to do. So that's a long way, such a long digress to tell you how I got involved in property. I'll tell you how I got involved in property. It was in Wandsworth. I bought my first property in Wandsworth. Now, it was on a road called Sudlow Road. I'm not very good with names and memories, but tell me about roads, tell me about how many properties I bought in a building, I'll be able to tell you the number. And Sudlow Road, I loved Sudlow Road. It was a road full of lovely Victorian terraces. Now, the thing is, in East Putney, you know, about 100 metres down the road, you were buying a one-bedroom flat for about 100,000 back then. On Sudlow Road, you could get a whole house for £100,000. You're literally crossing over Putney Bridge Road. Now, why didn't people want to live on this road? Well, there's a council depot at the back, and there's a railway line at one end. And then you've got the Wandsworth one-way system. Has anyone been to the Wandsworth one-way system? It's a busy one-way system, but you couldn't hear any noise, but it was close enough. And I thought to myself, I was utterly convinced that people would want to buy a house on this road one day. And being the risk taker that I was, this house had been on the market for 18 months. I just thought, let me take a stab at it. This will be my first house. It needed lots of work doing to it, and it would take me a good couple of years to sort of do the work. But that's what I bought. And we all know what happened. Property market started to rise, and within 2 years, basically I'd sold the house for more than double. And so that was really my sort of life, my entrance into the world of property. I could tell you more about the property if you want me to.
Well, I think it might be interesting to see sort of how successful you yes. were in that field.
Well, it took me a good 6 or 9 months, probably about 9 months to sell the property because I painted the walls orange. The thing is, it was a lovely house. I'd done it nicely, but you don't do those sorts of things, do you? You don't sort of like sand the floors down and paint them red, which is what I did. And I wanted to do this kind of decorative effect on one of the doors, which was paint it multicolored. So it was an acquired taste. I learned my lesson from... But I eventually did sell it. It wasn't the fact that people were not interested. They just didn't want to do the work in it to kind of get it back up to scratch. But having sold it, what did I do? Well, I thought to myself, look, now is my opportunity because I'm more than double my money. Why don't I invest that in another property? I'm going to need a house because I was looking to propose to my new girlfriend who became my wife. And so we bought this lovely house in Pinner. And I extended it into sort of like a 4-bedroom, 2-bathroom house with a big kitchen and put a big Miele kitchen in there as well. So it was a beautiful house. And then I quickly refinanced the house, which is effectively just taking the money from the profits or, how it had risen in value and basically went out on a shopping spree. So I was using all that money. It was probably about £150,000. To effectively buy something in the order of 12 flats. Now, you might be thinking, how is that going to happen? Well, quite easily, because back then property prices were low, you could get away with putting down £10,000 or £15,000 on a flat, and then the rest would be on a mortgage, and then you'd rent it out, basically. And so literally within, must have been about 18 months, I was probably sitting on a portfolio of 15 flats, bought this house, and it all really started from that one kind of risk-taking venture on Sudley Road. But the thing is, I wasn't cut out for DIY, and I definitely wasn't cut out for decorating, as I mentioned earlier, because I'd always choose the wrong colours. And I thought to myself, this is not really for me, I don't do DIY, I don't know how to use a drill. These 15 flats, every now and then there's maintenance issues, and I was one of those people thinking, well, I could cut a corner here. I could do it myself, like decorating, for example, instead of getting someone else to do it to save money. It just wasn't working out. And so what I thought is, why don't I try something else? Why don't I try buying off-plan properties? And actually, as I was driving in, I saw all those developments that are coming up. Sorry, I think that's possibly my mic, but hopefully you can still hear me. And so I got involved in this kind of world of buying properties from plan. So you'd go to a builder like Taylor Wimpey or Barrett's, and you'd say to them, look, I want to buy this property, this flat. I'll reserve it. I'll look at all the plans, all the drawings, all the specification, all the things you're going to put in there. I'm happy with it. I'm going to instruct a solicitor, and I'm going to exchange contracts on that flat. Now, often those buildings might take a year or 18 months to basically be finished. But I like the idea that I was putting my money down on a property and I had enough time to find the balance of the money. And what's more, if the market is improving, then basically that property I bought for 100,000 might be worth 120. And so I thought to myself, that makes better sense than actually buying an existing property that I've got to then look after and all the maintenance stuff. The difference being that possibly I'd be making money on the rent, whereas in this case I wouldn't. But then I had an idea. I said, what if I bought this property from, let's say, Taylor Wimpey, and then I sold on the contract? So assuming that I bought this property for £100,000, I haven't paid £100,000, I've only reserved it, I've exchanged contracts on it, And what if I then find a buyer like this lady over here and say, look, do you want to buy this property for £110,000? You can buy the contract off me. Now, back then, you know, this is in the early 2000s, and even late, you know, yeah, early 2000s, loads of people were buying these contracts from builders and selling them on. And I tried my hand at it. And as these properties came to completion, I managed to sell them on for a significant amount of profit. And then I had this crazy idea. I mean, this is utterly crazy, but this is what I did, which was I spoke to my mum and I said, look, why don't we buy 30 flats? Just go to a builder and say, look, we'll take 30 of your flats, we'll reserve on them, we'll exchange contracts, and then we'll sell them on. But there weren't many areas in the country where I could afford to buy 30 flats. But Bradford was selling really, really cheap flats. So you're able to buy flats for like £30,000-£40,000. So you can imagine that I could exchange contracts on a flat for, let's say, £4,000, being 10% of the £40,000 value, and sell on the contract. That's what I did. I bought these 30-odd flats, sold them on, and then I had this utterly, utterly mad idea, which was there was this lovely development in Leeds. The prices were a lot higher there, and I wouldn't have the money to exchange on these contracts. But I went to this building, and I said, you know, I like this building, and you've got 101 bedders in this building. I want to buy the lot. And this guy was really resistant, you know, because he must have been thinking to himself, you know, who is this guy? Does he have the money to back, you know, being able to buy 100 flats that might mean that I need to find the best part of £1 million on the day when I have to exchange contracts? So I go to him, look, I'm utterly serious. Instead of paying you £1,000 reservation, I'll pay you £2,000 reservation. So I knew I had £200,000 in my account. And he agreed. He did no checks on me whatsoever. It went to solicitors. So basically, I've got 2 months to find £900,000 to exchange on these contracts, which I didn't have. How was I going to find the money? Well, my idea was simple. I'd been a salesman selling furniture. All I needed to do was to find about, you know, 80, 90 people. I didn't need to sell all of them, but as long as I found 80 or 90 people that would exchange contracts on the same day that I exchanged contracts with the builder. So I had something like two months. I could probably string it out for another month because I knew how it worked with solicitors. You know, you can use some delay tactics. And so what I did was I started to network. And it was quite an easy thing, I found, to do. It sounds like a daunting task, but for me, I thought, no, this is peanuts, because you just drop it into conversation with lots and lots of affluent people. And so I would just network with the right people, and people knew that I was kind of doing well for myself. You know, I got 15 flats, and yeah, so I'm just buying, you know, these units up in Leeds, you know. The market is just going crazy up there, and you know, it's got the third biggest finance sector in the country, and there's about 300 accountancy firms and 200 law firms, and you just engage in conversation, and people start to then ask questions, and I say, yeah, no, if you want one, you know, I can get you one of the apartments. Oh, really? Can you? And I started to speak to people that say, you know what? Instead of 5 apartments, you know, I'll take 10, and quickly I sold them on. And that's effectively how I started my business. I was effectively using other people's money. And the business grew at an exponential rate. It would grow at an exponential rate if you don't have to use other people's money. So effectively, I was going across to builders across the country. You know, I was going to Barrett's, I was going to Taylor Wimpey, I was going to Crosby Homes, I was going to Urban Splash. And I was buying whole blocks. In one development in Leeds, I bought 450. In the whole of Leeds, over those few years, I bought 700 apartments. You know, I bought in Sheffield, in London, in Manchester, all over the country. It was whole blocks. People used to think, you know, this guy's absolutely crazy. There was this one block in London. As you go in on the way to Limehouse, I don't know if you've ever been to Limehouse, but it's a couple of stops from Canary Wharf. And Bellway Homes had this block. It was 102 apartments. You see, I remember numbers. The deal cost me about £33 million. And the word out there was, this guy's utterly crazy to pay Bellway Homes £33 million. It wasn't worth £33 million. You know, it was the biggest risk take that I took, because I had 6 months to sell it. But I knew there was one person that would buy all the one bedders off me, which was 40 units. So as far as I was concerned, I was taking a risk on 60 units. But Bellway never wanted to sell it to me. They were going to put a show apartment together. They were 6 months from completion, and I forced their hand. And they thought, well, you know, we've got to take this. And I still made money on it. But then we all know what happened in 2008. But that's probably another question you want to ask me.
Obviously, your success rate was quick and rapid and very high. Did it change you at all? Did it improve you, or how did it affect you?
Well, it's interesting because I was talking to someone today that I haven't spoken to for 20-odd years, and I'm on LinkedIn, and I went to university with this guy, and we were really good friends, and I don't know what made me think, but to just sort of, I don't know why, I just wanted to sort of contact him again, so I did, you know, I found him on LinkedIn, well, I just sort of researched to see if he was on there, and he was, and we spoke for a good hour today. And I was talking about I asked him loads of questions. He was talking about his life, and I shared about my life. And he said, but you're not on Facebook or anything like that. And I said, look, basically, I'm just living this kind of low-profile life. I'm not on social media. And the reason that I'm not on social media is because, just because of the way that I was living my life, I suppose, when I made money. You know, because I became a ruthless person, an arrogant person. There were probably a lot of people that didn't like me because of the kind of person that I was, you know. I remember this one lady that was, selling properties for me, for example, and we'd agreed a commission rate, and then I never paid her the full amount of money. You know, so I was ruthless, I was cutthroat, I wasn't treating people well. And if you imagine the scale of the business, you know, if you're buying blocks across the country, you know, I don't know how many apartments I've bought, you know, but possibly a couple of thousand, I would have thought. And if you bought that kind of number, you've dealt with a lot of people. Lots of influential people, high-profile people, just normal investors. And as you can imagine, what happened with 2008, well, the credit crunch would have decimated the business, but also all of these lives that were kind of caught up in it all. And so that's why I kind of left, you know, kept a low profile. But it utterly, utterly changed me as a person. My wife knew me as a teacher. She was a teacher. You know, I'd started out in this school teaching, and she was one of the teachers that looked after the new students, the new student teachers. And I ended up going out with her and marrying her in the end. And she knew me as, you know, somebody who was on £10,000-£12,000 a year because teacher salaries were really bad when I started out. But then suddenly you're in this league where, you know, if you want to spend £15,000 on a night out, you can do that. You know, and I'd gone from that extreme, you know, to the other extreme. And it totally went to my head. And so it affected my character in a big way. So my, you know, my parents, I was ruthless with everybody. You know, I just kind of, I didn't take any advice. My mother kept on saying, slow down, Manoj. The thing is, I didn't know how to slow down. I remember being on this holiday in Mauritius, and you're meant to enjoy holidays, aren't you? You've got your family, you've got enough money, you go and stay in a lovely place. We had a suite, and there was this private island that was attached to this hotel. And my wife and my children were enjoying this private island. I mean, it is absolutely stunning. You know, it's to die for, this kind of holiday. And I remember on this one holiday, I'm in the corner of this beach, and my wife has brought a bag with her, and I find this tatty piece of paper in the bag and a pen, and I'm writing down this business strategy on how to expand the business. So I was kind of on this conveyor belt, I felt, on this treadmill. The thing is, I'm going at relentless speed, and the thing is, I don't know how to get off it. And the thing is, I think that every time I do a deal, it's like I'm going to reach the top, and I'm going to find something there. Because when you get to the top, you think you're going to feel something. You're going to feel elation. You're going to feel contentment. But the thing is, all those feelings don't come. And so I was very discontent with my life. I wasn't happy with my life. And because I was always out, because I was always networking, I was always doing deals at all kinds of hours, you know, I was never at home. And the result of that was that I started to live a very unfaithful life. And so everything was kind of just destructing around me. Relationships were getting fractured. I remember one of my kids saying to me, when I watched a film with them one day, they said, Dad, that was the best day. We're on this holiday in this cottage in the Cotswolds. They said, Dad, that was the best day that we had on all holiday. And I was like thinking to myself, you know, why? You know, we did go out and about in different places on a holiday. But the thing is, I was probably on my phone a lot of the time. You're on holiday, but you're not really there. And I watched a film with my children, and I realized, gosh, that's probably one of the few times that I ever spent any quality time, you know, with my family. So no, it was a self-destructive kind of lifestyle. It utterly changed me.
Thank you. You've mentioned 2008, and probably most people can remember something about that time. How did that affect you and your business?
We'd exchanged on about 900 apartments as we moved into 2008. 2008 was going to be like the massive year for me. 2007 had been brilliant. I bought a house in a private estate. I bought another house in the private estate a few months after because I was already bored of the first house that I bought. So you can imagine that kind of lifestyle. And then we moved into 2008, and I've got these 900 apartments that I bought around the country that are going to be, completing in 2008 and sort of 6 months of 2009. So that's my pipeline. And so on some of these flats, I've really made a stupid amount of profit. You know, on some of these apartments, I've probably added on 50 grand. So you can just imagine, you work the numbers, but there's millions and millions of pounds that are going to be coming in. And you suddenly wake up to this credit crunch when the mortgage market collapses. And you've got all these investors around the country. Not only did the mortgage market collapse, so how are all these investors going to get funding? And some of the people that I sold on to were business people, affluent people, but they've got investments, and all their investments have gone down as well. And the houses they're currently living in have gone down in value as well. And all the property that I've sold for like £50,000 more might now only be worth £100,000 less. And so the reality was that actually they were worth less than what I'd bought them for in the majority of cases. I remember, you know, meeting up with builders and estate agents like Knight Frank and Savills, you know, the big agents that do a lot of these deals. And, you know, you might go out for lunch and you might, you know, have a really expensive meal. Or if I'm kind of trying to get somebody to buy some properties off me, take them to some Michelin star restaurant, you know, really, really, you know, spend a lot of money on them, knowing that they're going to, you know, sign on the dotted line, you know, a few months later or something like that. And I found that during the credit crunch, I remember meeting up with one of the developers on the M1 at a service station around a cup of tea. And I can't remember who actually put their hand in their pocket that day to actually buy the cup of tea. That's the extreme it was. The tap was just turned off. And so we were in the firing line. You know, I could have gone after all these investors. You could have then started to pour money into the solicitor and say, you know, or into the lawyers, you know, through litigation and basically try and force these people to complete on their transactions. You see, it was a chain. You see, the banks wanted their money from the builders. The builders wanted their money from me because they want, you know, the equivalent of, let's say, £20 million on that building to pay the banks £15 million and make their £5 million profit. They're going to get that not from me, but from my investors because I sold on the contracts. But how are my investors going to find that money? And so we had situations across this country where, you know, like the mortgage lenders, like Mortgage Express, are going bust. You know, the actual banks are starting to be bailed out by the government. The builders are going bust. A number of them did, but a lot of them managed to survive. There was no point in me trying to go after all my investors. They can't complete on these transactions. You know, a lot of them couldn't. And basically what we did, it felt like being in an earthquake because all the money you expect to come in isn't going to come in. Your kids are at private school and you're thinking, well, my salary is basically stopping, so what am I going to do with my kids' education? I've got big mortgages, how am I going to pay this? But all I could do in terms of business was to basically just get the builder and the investors somehow together to say, look, you've got to somehow do a deal. You know, you can sue me if you want to, but what are you going to get out of me? You're not going to get much, because basically I'm losing all my money. And anyway, there's 15 creditors after me. It was painful, but we did the best we could, which was, out of those 900 apartments, we got about half of them to complete on their transactions, which people must think, how did you do that? But I basically just said to these builders, you know, and a lot of them were suing me. There were claims going into the courts to bankrupt me. So it was very nasty. The people that were lovely to you were suddenly, like, you know, aggressive to you. I remember seeing this one car parked outside my house. You know, and I'm like thinking, you know, what's happening? You know, is this person, you know, going to come in and kill me or something like that? Because there were some dodgy people that I'd actually done business with. So it was terrifying as well. But I said, look, you're going to have to reduce the price. You're going to have to contract directly with these investors. I'm going to have to come out of the chain and just do a deal with them, because otherwise you're not going to get anything. And that way, at least the banks are going to get something. And so that's really what happened in terms of the property side.
Thank you. I know that 2008 hit home a little closer and more emotional than losing the property. Can you tell us about what happened with your family and that year as well?
You know, sometimes when things... I'm sure many of you have been in a situation where everybody goes through a tough time in their life, don't they? There's not anybody that doesn't go through a tough time. Things might be good for a season, and then you go through a tough time. It could be ill health, or it could be relationship problems or something, you know. And for us, everything kind of came at once. Because, you know, with the credit crunch, it just destroyed the business, pretty much. We didn't lose everything, but we lost pretty much everything. But I didn't lose my home. And actually, I'll tell you a bit about how I didn't lose my home a bit later on. And I was in and out of hospital because I used to hyperventilate. And when I hyperventilated, I thought I was having a heart attack. The thing is, I wasn't having a heart attack. I was having like an anxiety attack. And so what would happen is I'd freeze. So I wouldn't be able to move. You know, it was such intense sort of, you know, anxiety. And I'd end up in hospital and it'd take hours for me, you know, to get kind of sensation in my arms and legs because I'd just freeze. And, you know, anyway, that's a different story. But thing is, my son was a sickly child. And the thing is, as a dad in business, yes, I loved my son, but I seemed to love money more. And my son had been hospitalized on 6 occasions with breathing difficulties when he was born and when he was 1 year old. But when he turned into 2 years old, he just turned 2. I remember being in the office, and my wife had taken my son to the GP, and I didn't know about this. Or she probably tried to call me, but I probably didn't answer because that's the kind of person I was. You know, I was so consumed by my world of work. And this was right at the beginning of 2008. So before the impact of the credit crunch has happened, this is what happened right at the start. And then kind of all the, you know, the business side kind of just started to happen literally within a few weeks after that. My wife takes my son to the GP. And the GP does not see my wife, even though my wife is concerned for our child. And I think the reason was that she was probably down listed as an over-anxious mother. You know, because my son had severe, you know, asthma, but he'd been in hospital 6 times, and they sometimes kept him in hospital for a week. And the thing is, we knew the drill. You'd rush him into the hospital, they'd give him the nebulizer, and he'd be absolutely fine. And if he's not fine, they'd keep him in for 3 or 4 or 5 days, and then he'd come home. And I got a phone call from my wife. The GP saw my son in the end and called for an ambulance straight away. And so my wife is calling me in the ambulance, get to the hospital. And I rushed to the hospital. It's Northwick Park Hospital in Harrow, because at that time we were living in Pinner still. I think the transaction on the other house hadn't happened yet. Anyway, so we end up in hospital. You know, I'm flying in there at lightning speed, and he's being given the nebulizer, except the nebulizer is not working. You know, I think they give him 3 rounds of nebulizer. And then, you know, there's panic stations, and so we're rushing into resuscitation. And so I'm holding my son. There's two nurses, and we get into the resuscitation, and he's just by the bed over there, and he stops breathing. And you know that your children are important to you, but how often is the case, that other things kind of, you know, take priority in your life. The things that don't really matter, like money and like business. And I'm holding my son and he's not breathing. And I don't know where all the people came from, but literally within, you know, within seconds, the room is just packed. When I mean packed, it is packed. And not just packed with one doctor, but there was about 15 people in there. But one after another, they kept on calling more doctors in. There was 5 doctors in there. And we were ushered into the room next door. And obviously, so my son is not breathing for a, you know, for a certain amount of time, and they have to intubate him. And there's all commotion. And we're ushered into the room next door because you're not meant to be there in one of those situations, because they just need to get on and work on my son. What do you do in one of those situations when you've made money your God and you're really up against it and you know there's nowhere else to go and the money that you've earned is not going to make a blind bit of difference. It's not going to help you in that situation. So what do? You collapse to your knees in prayer. And I believe, you know, my belief is that, well, I believe that even the atheists do that, and you do hear atheists do that, because there's an innate sense, I believe in all of us, that God does truly exist. And in our hour of need, there is only one that you can call on when you've tried everything else that is humanly possible and it doesn't work. And so I did collapse to my knees in prayer with my wife, and I felt a fraud. You know, one of the initial thoughts that came to me as I was praying, you know, in a very, very strong way, sorry about that, was actually that I'd lived a sinful life. You know, things just flash before you that, you know, all these thoughts, it's like a torrent of thoughts, loads of thoughts. They just flash before you. Oh my goodness, you know, I'm praying to God for help now, but I've been unfaithful to my wife. My wife didn't know I was being unfaithful. For years I was unfaithful. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I've sinned so profusely in my life. I've treated so many people badly, and now I'm praying to God. You know, I don't know which God I was praying to, but when I was in that school in Kenya, I felt something in that school. I felt something of the tangible presence of God. Because when I left that school, it was like that presence that was around in that school wasn't there anymore. And that presence started to return. In that place, when I was sort of collapsed to my knees in prayer and praying. Anyway, my son was basically wired up. They had to call this thing called CATS, which is like a hospital on wheels. And they got him to St. Thomas's in London. And he's basically in critical condition. They don't know why his airways are shut down. There's all kinds of complications. You know, in resuscitation, they'd been working on him for hours. And I remember going in and out, looking at them, but there's sweat pouring off them. And I know there was problems with carbon dioxide levels. So we don't know what the future holds for my son and what made his airways shut down. And what do you do in one of those situations? You just weep, don't you? I've never cried for anything, but I wept for my son. For 4 days, I wept for my son. You know, I look at him and I weep. The doctors come and I weep. The nurses come and I'm crying. And I remember the consultant telling me on the 4th day, not really what I wanted to hear, which was, I'm really sorry, Mr. and Mrs. Reiter, but, you know, your son suffered a huge trauma. You know, we're still trying to work out what is going on, but he's not going to open his eyes for some time yet. Because the question you're always asking as a parent is, you know, but is my son going to be all right? Is he going to open his eyes? And she's telling me, no, I'm really sorry. You know, we're not anywhere close to anything like that. And yet what was resonating was the fact that this Christian couple that I'd met, my children going to private school, and this couple had come over, this family had come over from America. The gentleman worked for the American Navy in Northwood, and I'd met them, my wife had met them, and they were so lovely. You know, this family, they'd invited us into their home, and they did hospitality well, and everything revolved around food and genuine friendship. Thing is, I didn't have time for Christians because I'd met some Christians along the way, you know. And if I'm honest, there's obviously a lot of Christians in this room, but I thought they were a weird bunch. It's a weird bunch. They dress funny, they talk funny, you know. And that was my perception of them, you know. They were different to the rest of the people that I met. But this family were just, you know, people on my level. I could get along with them. And And the thing is, I was so hospitable, you know, as a South Asian, you know, always in welcoming people into your home. And this Christian family were always welcoming us into their home. And they prayed for my son when my son was in hospital. And it was Marcy and Nick, that's their names. And Marcy, when she found out that my son was in hospital, and she phoned my wife, she fell on her knees and she wept bitterly. She wept. She wept for my son. And the thing is, in my Hindu faith background, I'd never experienced that kind of compassion and love. They obviously, you know, there's lots of Hindus that are loving, but I'd never experienced people that are outside of your kind of close-knit family unit praying like that. You know, they got the whole church to pray. And they were praying a simple prayer, which was that Jesus, they're praying in the name of Jesus, they believe in a God that's real and that's mighty, that Jesus would heal my son. And that carries you, that gives you hope, that gives you strength. And for 4 days I'm crying, but they're carrying me through this. And what happened during those 4 days is I remember standing outside a chapel at, it's in the Evelina Ward in St. Thomas's. And I'm standing outside this chapel and I feel something, that, you know, that presence, that feeling that I'd had in that primary school. And this family are praying and they're getting their churches to pray. And the consultant says to us on the fourth day, your son is not going to open his eyes. She goes and does the ward round. It takes about an hour. And as she comes back round, my son, despite what she had said, that consultant, you know, my son just sat up in bed. He bolted upright in bed. And the way he bolted upright in bed, you know, yeah, I can still remember it, although it's so many years ago, but it is literally like, there's no problem. You know, it was a, you know, two-year-old boy that's just turned two, you know, sitting up in bed and just starts pulling away at the wires. And, you know, there's so much elation and joy. And even right now, I'm thinking to myself, I know of people, you know, whose children have been in that situation, they haven't survived, you know. And my heart goes out for those people that, you know, sadly have lost. You know, no parent should lose a child. You know, no parent should lose a child. It should always be the other way around. And if there's anybody that has lost a child, I'm really sorry in this room. But after all the elation and joy, you know, what do? You turn around to your wife. This is what I did, and I said, it happened quite quickly after all the tears and joy, you know, something that shocked my wife, which was, I'm going to go to that couple's church to say thank you. You know, because there was something about the compassion and love that they'd shown us that I'd never, ever experienced anywhere else. You know, and I know my parents were devout Hindus, and I have so much respect for them, but I never saw them do something like this for somebody they didn't know well. You know, but this couple would have done it for anybody. It could have been somebody on the street that would have brought that person in, you know, and fed them. That's the kind of family they were. So I was going to say thank you to this couple. Anyway, I went to a church. Did I enjoy it? No. It was bad. You know, it was a bad... No, it was a good church. It was my mindset was bad. But I found it utterly boring. Look, I was a business person. And I wanted the kind of wildlife, you know, and because although the credit crunch was, you know, just starting, you know, it would still take a few months before that would kind of unfold, and I didn't really enjoy it, and I didn't get it. However, they invited me to another church on the third Sunday, and my plan was not to go to church on a third Sunday because I could be doing some deals on a Sunday, and I was outside this building. And I don't know why it was different in this church, but I think there are different churches and people, you know, different churches work for different people, don't they? Because we're all different. That's just the reality of it. And that other church, it was packed. There was loads of people that were getting a lot out of it. But I went into this church on that third Sunday and I was outside and I walked in and I felt something. I felt it in the air. I could have held on to it. Thing is, I heard the Christian message again, you know, that same message that I'd heard, you know, in primary school. I'm basically hearing it again, you know, and the message is that the Creator has died for the created, you know, the King has died for his servants, you know, God, you know, loves humanity so much, you know, that he's giving himself. And the thing is, when you hear the message and that new kind of, when you're ready for it, it takes root. You suddenly realize, you know, that cross is not just a symbol that you see, you know, around on people's necklaces or on church buildings. But actually, you know, my sin, my wrongdoing, and I'd done a lot of wrong, had basically, you know, nailed Jesus to the cross. You know, it was my wrongdoing that had sent him to the cross, and that utterly, utterly broke me. And one day, you know, in the church, you know, this Soul Survivor Church in Watford, you might have heard of it, you know, I just decided, you know what, this makes sense now. It really makes sense. I believe that this God, you know, healed my son, and I know that God doesn't answer all our prayers, but for some reason, he intervened in that situation. He wanted my son to be healed. Maybe it's to come to places like this. And, you know, I do go around the country and chat from time to time. Not huge amounts, but I always see it as a privilege. You know, maybe it was for something like this that, you know, one person might come to know and love Jesus. Because I came to love Jesus Christ that day, you know, my Lord and Savior. You know, this is the one who gave his life for me. And it was an extraordinary experience I had. You know, I went to church as one person, and everybody's experience is different. You know, I speak to lots of Christians, and some people it's just a gentle transformation, you know. And obviously, God is still transforming me, but for me, I had a massive conversion experience to the point that my wife didn't recognize me. So I walked out of church, you know, with a new mindset, a new vision, a new purpose, you know, which was to serve God wholeheartedly. Because that day, I really gave my life to him. I really did, because I knew that God had saved my son. And, you know, for about 6 months, and I'm waffling on now, but for about 6 months, you know, I used to pray to God outside, because I used to be a smoker, so I liked going outside, except I stopped smoking. But anyway, I enjoyed praying outside, and I used to pray to God and thank God, you know, God, you saved my son. You saved my son. And it was for about 6 months I used to hear this. It's like a whisper in my spirit saying, yeah, I heard those prayers and I saved your son, Manoj. I saved your son. But I always wanted to remember, Manoj. You know, it's his Father God speaking to me. I always wanted to remember that my son Jesus, I did not save. You know, my son Jesus went to the cross that you might have life. And so I hope and pray that, you know, every time that I look at my son, you know, from time to time, that I'm reminded, yeah, that my son does live, you know, but Jesus Christ, yes, he does live, but he also paid the price for my sin on the cross. He died for me.
Thank you. Since that amazing conversion experience, which is really wonderful to hear, can you just tell us what difference Jesus is making in your personal life, yeah, and also your business life, because
yes,
that's...
Yeah.
Part of it as well.
With just a quick story just before I get onto that, because you know, when I became a Christian, I remember seeing on this bookshelf this biography on George Whitefield. He was a great evangelist, Christian evangelist, that went out to the States and basically shared the good news message of Jesus Christ with thousands. Many of you will be familiar with him. He was about the same time as John Wesley, so he was, except the Wesleys were here and Whitefield went to the States. I was given that book in primary school by the headmaster when I heard the Christian message. And I remember becoming a Christian and seeing, you know, on the bookshelf, the George Whitefield book, and thinking to myself, how did that book travel with me for like 20-odd years? And I saw a Bible there and a Book of Common Prayer. I was given all of these books when I was in primary school. And after becoming a Christian, I ended up getting a job, a part-time job in a Christian organization. And I didn't make the connection, but it was only shortly afterwards I made the connection that the building that I was working in was named after George Whitefield. It was Whitefield House. And I thought to myself, oh my goodness, God, you've been chasing me for all these years. Let me read this book. It must be really, really important I read it. And I read it, and it was just inspirational stuff about this person that he was prepared to die for the sake of sharing the good news message of Jesus Christ. You know, those days when he was ill in America, and he would get out of his deathbed, you know, literally, and travel somewhere, lest someone doesn't hear the message that Jesus Christ died, and that if you put your faith in him, you can have life. That salvation is in him. You don't need to earn it. It's a free gift. It's just a coming to God and saying, God, I'm sorry, and I receive you in my life. I read that book. Just after I read it, somebody whose surname is Whitfield contacted me and said, would you come and share something in my church? I just shared that with you because, you know, God is constantly chasing all of us, isn't he? But are we attentive? The transformation in my life is huge because I know, you know, it's not because I made that transformation happen. It's not any goodness that I've done, but by God's grace, you know, I received the Holy Spirit when I went to church that day, which I didn't realize what it was, but then I found out, well, look, that's the presence of God in my life, and the presence of God changes you. But yeah, so many changes. My work life changed. I'm still involved in business. I mean, most of my business went. But by the grace of God, I wasn't made bankrupt. And I prayed to God for these two claims that had gone into the courts to bankrupt me, that God would basically make them do a U-turn. And I used to go into a church building like this, and I used to pray for hours, because there's no point in me going to the office during the credit crunch because it's just falling apart. Only God can help. And actually, both those creditors, builders, withdrew their claims. And so, although I lost most of my properties and wealth, you know, my house I didn't lose. But that didn't matter anymore because you need money to survive, but the love of money is just destructive. And when you've got God, you've got something far more important. Lots of things changed. My work life in terms of business, for example. I'm involved in business, but I didn't want to be involved in a business that was just focusing about making money. I said to God, if you want me involved in business, it's got to be about communicating the message of your love to other people. Otherwise, I can't see the point of it anymore. You know, I want to be involved in something that's intentionally promoting your name. And so I ended up starting this publishing house called Instant Apostle. And it's a Christian publishing house. It publishes probably 25 books per annum. It's a small, independent publishing house. And this is a transformation that Jesus has made because it's not run on a commercial kind of model. So it's run on a model that we will publish a book even if we know it's going to sell 300 or 400 copies. But we prayed over it and we sense in our spirit, look, this is an important book that could potentially impact a few hundred people. It's never going to make us much money. So we end up finding these very niche books. Often authors are first-time authors. And yet in my world of work, I know lots of high-profile Christians that could write. But the thing is, our calling is not to chase after them, but actually to chase after these often new authors. God wants to say a new thing to the world around us. It's like a prophetic voice, a new thing. And some of them have gone on to become bigger writers as well. So that's, business is still something I'm involved in. I'm a church pastor now as well, which I haven't got the training like Philip has, but I look after a Baptist church. So it's interesting that I don't come from a Baptist background. I was, you know, confirmed in an Anglican church, soul survivor. But I used to preach occasionally in this church in Barking in East London. And it wasn't a pleasant experience when I went to preach. This is what I found out about Baptist churches, because it's very democratic, isn't it? If you're a Baptist, it's very democratic. And the congregation rules. And the thing is, I brought a few books to sell on the day. And I got chastised after I'd given the sermon. And somebody stood up on the stage and was telling me off. And I'm like, oh my goodness. There's not many Baptist churches I've spoken to, but is this how it works in Baptist churches? You get invited and then you get basically slammed at the end for bringing some books. The guy said, but it's the house of God. You can't sell books in the house of God. How can you do this? And I'm like, oh my gosh, what's going on? Anyway, I drove home that day and I walked into my house and I was praying to God because I'd had a really good experience. I know it was bad because of what happened, but I felt that I'd given an important message for that church. And as I walked into my house, I felt God saying to me, no, I said this to God. I said, if ever you made me into a church leader, I bet you'd send me to a church like that. It was without a minister for 3 years, and there are lots of lovely people in this church, but it did have its issues and problems because it didn't have a minister. And then I felt this kind of sense that God was actually telling me to go and serve this church. It makes no sense because I live in Rickmansworth, and this church is in Barking. And then I thought, let me pray with a Baptist minister I know very well. He was a regional minister for the London Baptist Association. We prayed over the phone. I said, this is a crazy idea, but I think I'm meant to go and help this church. We prayed over the phone for a clear sign, like really, really clear sign, if I'm meant to help this church, because I'm not a trained minister. So this would have to be something quite extraordinary for this to happen. And what happened was the day after I prayed, I got on the plane and to go on holiday. This was in August last year. And there was somebody from the church in the row in front of me. Now, the night before, I'd been... as I tried to check in, it wouldn't allow me to change my seat, although I tried. So I thought, well, fair enough, I'll just sit where I'm meant to sit. And this lady turned around and said, oh, you came and preached in our church. Why didn't you come and be our minister? I came back and I spoke to my friend and I said, look, I think I'm meant to help this church, but I don't know how this is going to happen. He said, let me go and see the deacons, because he was a regional minister. And the deacons said to him before my friend had asked him, they said, oh, this man which comes and has preached a couple of times, we think of asking him to be our pastor. And so that's what happened. So I'm an interim pastor in this church on a part-time basis. You can't do a lot in 2 days, but God can do a lot, which is great. And so I'm just trying to work my way in that new world of leadership and patience and love for everybody that walks into that space.
Thank you very much. We could go on... you could go on for a long time, and we could listen for a long time, and it would be good. But I did say I'd give an opportunity for any burning questions that you might have. There's one. Yes, please.
You did only very briefly mention that your wife was shocked by your change, but I was just really interested to know how she reacted and how.
Yes. So, only by God's grace did she stay with me. She comes from a Christian background, and her faith had gone to sleep. So she'd gone to church as a child. But her mother is an extraordinary woman of God. And she, when she was praying one day, God spoke to her and said that my wife will meet an Indian man, and to welcome this Indian man into her home. So my wife's Afro-Caribbean. And none of her family have had mixed marriages with Indian people, with South Asian people. But I started to work in this school, and basically what happened, I asked her out one day. And then my mother-in-law, you know, married now, she really welcomed me and said to Maria, my wife, she said, this is the man that I've seen. My wife was 25, extremely shy. She'd never had a boyfriend before. And people often say we look like a very odd couple. But God had, you know, facilitated that we were meant to be together. The thing is that you'd think that my wife's faith would suddenly wake up. But it never woke up. You know, her faith had gone to sleep. And I suppose this was just the norm. Her mother would say these sort of things from time to time, and she probably forgot about it. But the thing is, as soon as I went to church... you know, because I was the one that said to her, let's go to church. She'd said to me, I think a couple of years beforehand, let's go to Christmas service. And I'd reacted with such anger. Well, go to church, do what, you know. But when she saw the change in me, she just recommitted her life to God. And so we both started our Christian journey, you know, basically together.
Thank you.
So it's been nice, yeah.
Yes, please.
You know what? For me, the credit crunch was awful for a lot of people. You know, lots of people lost a lot of stuff in that time. And you know, a lot of high-profile people actually committed suicide during that time, because when you've got a lot of wealth and you lose it, there's the shame, there's the embarrassment, you know, because you kind of walk into a place with a kind of a, you know, a certain walk, don't you? When you've got money, you just behave in a different way because, you know, you've got all the money in the world. In my case, I'm glad that I was humbled by the credit crunch. I'm really, really pleased about that. You know, I used to drive a Mercedes. I now drive a Toyota Yaris. I can still afford a Mercedes. You know, I didn't lose, although I lost most of my wealth, you know, I could still afford one. But I just like that whole kind of being stripped of stuff. And I mean, I don't have money to go on lavish holidays or anything like that. You know, we go on a holiday a year. You know, so there's lots of luxury things we can't do. But we can do, you know, enough good stuff. But the thing is, I think God really needed to break me, because the power of money is strong, isn't it? And I think I needed to be brought to a place where that kind of power was gone, just so that I could focus my energy on Jesus Christ. And I'm not sure if the Lord will give me that kind of level of money again. And I don't even think I trust myself. So, you know.
Thank you very much, Manoj. And I think we can thank him for coming. And,
can I just say that for a question?
Yeah. And I mentioned earlier about the books at the back, but perhaps you need to do a book,
well,
book,
just,
book plug.
Just something to mention. I brought the... you know, the 2017-18 catalogue for Instant Apostle Publishing House, if you want to have a look at that. It's probably not that you might want a book, but actually there might be some people that write here that are looking to get a book published. So that's why I brought that. That's obviously my story, and I've reduced it to £5. That's my conversion story, which I've written it for Christians, but written it for non-Christians as well. But you might be fascinated with, obviously, because I come from a Hindu background, that often people from other faith backgrounds, Hindus, Muslims, and Sikhs, often have questions about Christianity. And this is a booklet that answers the key questions that Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, and Buddhists have with Christianity. We asked about 300 churches across the nation that were predominantly Asian churches that engage with Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, and Buddhists. You know, what are the big questions that they always have? And there were 16 questions that we kind of put together in one booklet. And so this is a booklet that helps Christians understand what those questions are, but it's a booklet to give away to those of other faith backgrounds as well. So, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I suppose as we go, we need to ask ourselves what matters to you. Because we've been challenged tonight about priorities. And I wonder what matters to you. What's the most important thing in your life? Is it your job, family, or money? I wonder what it is. But regardless to the past, we've heard tonight of a God of love and a God who forgives and a God who wants to give you the opportunity to make a new start, to have a new life, and to have a new hope. And that involves a choice. A man also had to make choices. We all have to make choices. And it wouldn't be great if you made a deliberate choice this evening to ask the Lord Jesus to forgive you and to give you that new start that we so desperately need. I'm just going to close with prayer, and then we can... I was going to say, the rest of the evening's your own.